I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. In 2017, I had the opportunity to speak with noted architect Lorcan O'Herlihy. We spoke about the ever-changing architectural landscape of Los Angeles. This conversation features a comparison between architecture in LA and Detroit. Most people don't realize how many similarities exist between these two cities. One that is reaching its limits with regard to growth, and the other which is in the process of a wholesale rebirth. You can decide which is which. Lorcan discusses the infill projects and stitching LA's vast landscape together. This chat is probably more relevant now than when we first had it last year, but slightly less relevant than it'll be a year from now. O'Herlihy talks about a bottom-up versus top-down strategy and the development of metropolitan cities. About halfway through this clip, you're going to hear O'Herlihy talk about a watershed moment for his practice. He was brought in to rehab a project next to a beloved Schindler home, and he talks about how his firm approached the new while blending the existing. That work landed him a large project in Detroit called Brush Park. The point is, great architecture is both new and existing in dense metropolitan areas, and some of it's worth saving. That doesn't necessarily mean that all of it's worth saving. You cannot simply wipe clean and start over, nor can you keep everything forever. Lorcan understands this and has masterfully applied a hybrid approach to his practice. Something else about O'Herlihy that you should know, he and his firm don't just work on big, pretty and expensive projects. Lorcan O'Herlihy Architects designs all types of projects, including bus stations and nonprofit projects. The thing that stands out most when speaking with Lorcan or looking at his work is the nature of what he designs and how he designs it. He's a no-nonsense individual. Not that he doesn't have the time or inclination to speak eloquently or artistically about the nature of the work, but he gets right to the point and focuses on the important parts. O'Herlihy wants you to know about his urban infill projects and his philosophy of creating remarkable work in dense, unforgiving terrain. He seems to enjoy the fight a little bit, the neighbors that don't want architects working in their neighborhoods because it means progress, and he doesn't mind the social constraints and municipal intrusions. It's all part of the gig. Before we get to Lorcan, you're going to hear from Peter Cully of Spatial Affairs Bureau. That is Cully's architectural firm with studios in Los Angeles, Richmond, Virginia, and London, England. Peter, as the name of his firm suggests, is fascinated with the uses of space and their uses in buildings and landscape architecture. We talk about experimentation and collaboration quite often on the show. Peter and Lorcan both exemplify the creative use of both ideas. Please enjoy first this conversation with architect Peter Cully. Convo by Design is presented by Snyder Diamond, always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath. Snyder Diamond is a family-owned and operated company that serves the Southern California design and architecture community, as well as discriminating homeowners, through remarkable customer service and a curated offering of kitchen and bath appliances, fixtures, and finishes. The products at Snyder Diamond include the industry's best, like the full line of Miele appliances. Miele, a family-owned and operated company offering industry-leading products since 1899. This includes a full line of refrigerators, ovens, steamers, cooktops, wine units, coffee machines, dishwashers, ventilation hoods, washers, and dryers. All of these products are made using the highest standards in manufacturing and industry-leading technology to provide a superior class of appliance. Form, function, and future. That's Miele. Pair that with the standard bearer when it comes to customer service, and Snyder Diamond delivers dreamy kitchens that exceed expectations. If that's not enough, right now, and for a very limited time, Miele is offering some amazing and very generous rebates and offers. For details on these, and to see the full line of Miele products, visit any of the three Southern California Snyder Diamond locations, or visit online at SnyderDiamond.com. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
We are, this is Convo by Design. We are at the LA Design Festival at Rho DTLA. We are recording for both Convo by Design and Design Etc., which is the official podcast of the LA Design Festival. So, Peter, when did you come to the States?
I first came, I had a sort of gradual shift, I think. I was working on a project in Virginia for the Museum of Fine Arts for a company based in the UK. So I spent about 5 years commuting for that project between the UK and Virginia, the East Coast generally. And then in 2008, in order to finish that project, I moved to the US full time. So it's now 10 years in the US, I would say, pretty much full time.
Where are you based? Out here in LA?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I would say that I'm based in LA. I think maybe about half of my time is in Los Angeles. But it's where all my belongings really are, let's say at least.
Yeah. How often do you commute? Hold on one second.
Hey, folks. Hi, guys. We're recording here. You're welcome. If you could just keep it down, please. Thank you.
Okay. So, do you do the majority of your work out here in the States or across the pond?
The majority of the work has been in the U.S., but one of the first projects I began developing when I, set up Spatial Affairs Bureau was a project in London for an artist, and that has taken 8 years to go on site, and now it is on site. And so, strangely, one of the first projects is taking me back now to the UK for quite a lot of my time. So I'm going maybe every month or 6 weeks to the UK. But when I first was based here, I was going back to the UK partly to work with the company I had worked with before, but now it's sort of in my own right. So it's quite a complicated business model in a way.
It sounds complicated.
But all the projects are too interesting to not go with it, So mostly it's been in the US, but it's been projects in New York, Memphis, Virginia and different places, and in Los Angeles. So even that's quite a lot.
New York, LA, and Memphis.
Yeah, and Virginia.
But Memphis is sort of like the one thing that doesn't really belong in that
well,
picture.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe Virginia sounds a bit more out of the loop in that, because there is actually a funny LA and Memphis connection through the music industry. There was a path, obviously, going backwards and forwards. And so, plus, I think in a sense, you recognize Memphis, maybe you recognize Los Angeles in Memphis more than you would New York, I think. There are definitely moments that I feel are very similar, particularly maybe this kind of condition, in the east side of downtown, where you get into an interesting industrial or post-industrial landscape. That often feels familiar to Memphis, or familiar of Memphis to me.
It's interesting when you go to Memphis and you look at it through the prism of an architect. Can you see the potential in a city like that as it's developing? And because you come from New York or LA, where you see it's pretty much established, and then you look at that, it's like, do you look at it like oh, the potential?
Well, that's a great question. I don't quite know how you came to that, but one of the reasons that I found Memphis so, I don't know, important maybe in my career is not only, do I have LA and New York, but I also have, this old world, London and Europe. And so I think as an architect, I was used to going to cities where there was a kind of grand architectural backdrop for monumental, historical, occasions, let's say. And then, so my very first visit to Memphis, I was met at the airport by a tour guide who drove you around with a CD with music sites. So it sort of started, but it wasn't only that, but it started with Aretha Franklin's birthplace, which is a tiny, 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 humble, abode in a very modest, non-monumental area. I think somebody owns it. It is kind of, it's understood. It's an important, but it doesn't look that way. And then I felt like, as these 2 hours went by, it was consistent that, we'd show up at the Lorraine Motel. So I think in the history of civilization, probably one of the more important spots on the planet. And, I quite often go there because I find it strangely sort of like being in the eye of the storm. It's sort of like calming somehow. But same thing, it's a very modest motel, a very modest balcony, the trajectory of the bullet travels through purely modest, non-distinguished urban landscape. And it sort of kept going like that. I would find, you know, these important sites, but the architecture was not reinforcing it. And I think that was a really good lesson for me, to understand that it doesn't have to be that way. So I don't think I would say that the aim as an architect is to, say, pull a place like Memphis up to be in line with, let's say, a grander situation. I think in the end that was an interesting story, that they don't have to be reinforced, or one doesn't have to reinforce the other in a kind of classical way. But in terms of potential, you know, there are definitely many. This project we worked on was a huge old Sears distribution warehouse. When there's one over here, you know, about a mile away, there were 11 across the country, and it had gone totally into ruin. And so that was very interesting, because it was a building project that does affect the city as a culture as a whole. And what they have done is sort of pick up various parts of the city and push it into the building, including a school, people live in it. We just finishing up quite a large art center inside. So there's definitely a lot of work to be done where I think architecture can assist an evolving set of social conditions. But it's just interesting. Maybe it's not about grandness, but it is about allowing conditions to be reabsorbed maybe into the urban environment. But what we were told when we first were involved, you know, we should, the urban overlay plan was that you should build up to the sidewalk and there should be 3 to 5 story tall buildings and whatnot. And I said, well, I don't think there's any economic basis for that to happen. So there's no point really having a plan that's just wishful thinking. And we said, we described Memphis actually as being unique, as almost like a rural looking city. And then we found some quite nice precedent for describing it that way. So we talked much more about creating intensity through a forest overlay, for example, and not relying on buildings to sort of try and make it feel like a vibrant world city. It's different, you know. And so I think maybe it's very useful to go to Memphis with an old world background and a New York understanding and an LA understanding, almost to recognize, no, we don't need to apply that to this place. You know, we apply some of the things we know about design, but we don't necessarily feel like, you know, density maybe is the big aim, for example. Maybe it's about dense moments, but not about trying to replicate this condition. It's a totally different set of economic circumstances, different history, different future coming. But it's interesting to compare.
I think it's interesting to compare. And also, when I talk about potential, I don't speak about it in the sense of simply going 3 feet off the curb and 3 stories high. But, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about things because, you know, in Memphis is one of those cities. It's almost like a Nashville. Nashville's the same thing. And because you have so many people that are flooding to these metropolitan areas, right, something has to give. Right?
Yeah.
And while you're talking, I'm thinking about other spots, and for some reason they're all morbid assassination sites too. Oddly enough, one comes to mind is Dealey Plaza.
Yeah.
In Dallas. Mm-hmm. Very much the same way. You know, the book Depository is remarkably unremarkable.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing special about mm-hmm. Dealey Plaza. As a matter of fact, it feels rural still. You know, you can.
Yeah, I haven't been to it. Actually, I have once, but not recently. I felt like maybe that had changed, because Dallas, I know, has changed a lot.
Dallas is growing immensely. I haven't been back in quite some time, but the last time I was there, you know, you still have the old courthouse, and you still have the view of the Trinity, and it's just, it still feels. And the same way here in L.A., you have connected, you have the Ambassador Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Ambassador Hotel was a remarkable place, but L.A. is one of those places that changes so quickly.
Mm.
It's not a rural situation.
No, but you're right. It might be a little bit in between. It's sort of, I think partly maybe that was referring to earlier. You can smell L.A. and Memphis, you know, somehow together, because L.A. is also not imperial. It's not monumental. There's much more, you know, sort of maybe tendency towards it, but essentially, I mean, it began maybe in a classic way and then that sort of blew apart. And maybe that's it, maybe that's what you're talking about, that it doesn't conform to the, you know, those sort of old worldy systems either. But so, you're right. A lot of people are coming to Memphis as a changing city, but there's also a lot of space. You know, there's a lot of it. Again, I think that maybe the way that it fills up is in an intriguing different way, and we mustn't, you know, rely on the sort of patterns that we can apply to, let's say, downtown LA or Glendale. maybe that will become relevant. I just don't feel like it is yet, and it might be a problem to do it that way.
It's so funny. And architecture is not one of those things. It's odd to say you can't really experiment with. I mean, I just had a conversation where you absolutely can experiment in architecture, but it's one of those things that, boy, you get it wrong. But LA is one of those places traditionally where people do come to experiment.
This that's why I'm here.
So that is why you're
totally
here.
Why I'm here. Yeah.
What do you want to do? What would you like to do?
You mean in LA?
No.
Or just in my life?
In your practice, with your firm, with your architecture.
I'd like to do more of the same, which means, I think, being somehow inherently connected to, I don't know how you want to describe it, cultural, in a broad sense, the sort of cultural clients. I look a little bit more to artists in the art world, even in the way I design, perhaps. So anyway, stay connected around that, loosely connected around that, but I think be able to do projects of different scales. I mean, the art center that I have just, you know, nearly finished in Memphis, is, I just love that scale of project, about 50,000 square feet inside a massive building. It's all about landmarks, it's almost like urban logics within a interior space. That came up also in the project that we did for sort of re-looking at the TBWA Shite Day headquarters. So I'd like to do more, I think, on that, I call them interior landscape scale. I'd like to do something, you know, where I get to start from scratch, maybe in LA. So that would be really good. I think maybe tap a little bit into the sort of gallery world, but also I would like to do more here, but I don't, you know, I don't want to totally focus the work here. I like having different projects in different places, and it's good, I think, for critical thinking, because you just have to be aware of the other cultures that told you a different way of doing it when you're on home turf, for example. And I do think the clients quite like that.
When you're working on a project for a TBWA Shite Day,
yeah,
advertising agency, where you're working on a project for a group of creatives, is that a different dynamic?
This is another great question. So at the time that I interviewed, if you like, with them, I was also starting up this project called the Richmond Bridge Park that somehow had been not exactly masterminded, but another group called the Martin Agency, who are sort of, they're in Virginia, in Richmond, but they're similar to TBW, or similar to Shite Day, in that they both sort of rejected Madison Avenue and were mavericks, you know, outside of New York. And they do actually come together, you know, in the awards ceremonies. Anyway, I was kind of petrified in terms of presenting to, you know, very high-end, very, very top-thinking creative ad people. And I thought, God, I've got to be really snappy in the way I present, because they're not going to be interested in too much fluff and blah. And I found it was great. I really liked the dialogue because, you know, they are fast, but they are totally strategic. They have to be, you know, is it going to make sense? And I think that really resonated with me, because I like to be, you know, experimental, but at the same time I want to know that the general context is pertinent, you know. So I think I found that really good. And then as I went into it more with TBWA Shite Day, the person that I was sort of assigned as my ultimate client was the top creative person. And what I learned from that was that we're creative people, we're very involved, let's say, in adjacent disciplines, but the brain works very, very differently according to your specialism. And so I found actually that a lot of times the ad agency creative person is probably not spatially driven. It's very, very different. So that strategically maybe right in terms of making the story straight, I think we were totally on track. But it was really interesting to see. There wouldn't be a reason why somebody who was particularly, you know, let's say extraordinarily gifted in one creative department would also be spatial. I think spatial thinking is probably, you know, fairly specific. So that was just very interesting. And so we found ways that we could describe what we were talking about that were, you know, available, because it, on one level, it was extremely accessible, again, this sort of strategic, you know, tagline way. But in fact, we had to work almost harder than with other clients to get across the sort of spatial propositions, well, which I liked. That was interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because, and it, again, in dealing with the advertising agencies in particular, which is a group of creatives, but dealing with the creative types, be it Silicon Valley or any digital group for that matter, but generally those on the creative side of business these days, spatial conversations, they're actively looking for workspace that isn't permanent to an individual. Mm-hmm. So use of space is we are in a revolution with, and I don't use that word lightly, but we're in a revolution as it relates to use of space, because there's way more shared space. Many people are working from home or home offices, so they're not even in the office full time, which also means you have to allocate more space for things that we never had before, like true telecommuting, mm-hmm, conference rooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as that's happening, have you noticed that that was something that you had to take into account? Are you seeing that more? Are you seeing it less? Or maybe it's going in the other direction?
Yeah, I mean, well, as far as which direction is going in, probably we're still all making that up, and I think that's where genuine testing is going on. And working with the TBWA Shiat Day model was great, because they were really the group that tested hot desking for the first time on a rigorous level, and it was a complete fiasco. And it was very sort of formally instigated and controlled, and it meant that is wonderful, really. Everybody put their filing cabinets in the back of their cars, and they were working in the parking lot with the trunk door open. And so, because you're going to work, you're going to find a way to make it work. So that's the kind of thing where the experiment was very good to try. And then I think as long as you listen to the outcome, then you can get something interesting. Anyway, so we had this kind of heritage, you know, of testing like that and wanting to test. And then we also had a sort of pressure to fit more people, you know, in the same space because of the ownership of the larger ownership of this organization. And that is a tendency, of course, to get part of the reason for open plan working is you can fit so many more people in. And so what we came up with was like, okay, well, there is some spatial benefit also for open plan. We could create spaces that maybe didn't exist when everything had to be individually, more individually organized. But then we also recognized, well, there are drawbacks of open plan. We know sometimes phone calls, just on very basic level, you know, phone calls interrupt people. Also, you can't necessarily monitor exactly what people are doing. Anyway, the outcome was that there should be a realm of different spaces people can work. One, they needed a very particular space that they could call their own, put their name on, maybe have a phone call, a phone line directed to, or a number somehow. But then maybe make that smaller than previously was assigned to them, but recognize that within one account space, there were four separate conference rooms where they could close the door. There were, you know, what we call these breakout spaces, I guess we're sitting at now. But then in tandem with that, we were developing, you know, let's call them almost like public spaces within the building that you could go to, you know, just the city analogy of the plaza or whatnot, you know, and there were several more of those happening. But I think what you probably realize is that when we, you know, the desk job was sitting at one desk for maybe your whole career, there was quite a bit of training that went into that, which started at school level. You know, you had your little desk with the inkwell, so you were having to be taught to work that way. And now that we've been sort of untaught, if you like, because we come out of the plane, we've got the phone, you sit down at the gate because you've got the catch-up vehicle, and that might be any chair, you know, and then maybe we go, you know, into the Uber and we carry on working. Maybe we're tired, so we might even lie down a little bit on the Uber, then we go home and it might be in the kitchen or the bedroom or whatnot. So I think we have now learned, we've either unlearned that very formal behavior or we've learned new behaviors about how you can actually deliver messages and work product to people. And I think that's really interesting because we probably reverted much more to a sort of primal way of moving and not sitting still in one spot, which was had to be that way. It was heavily engineered because that's how economically it could work to employ people. So maybe we've reverted much more to how we would be, you know, in the wild, where you would probably sit, you know, somewhere and do something, have certain conversations. So again, like an office that's big enough that you can do it, like there's enough space that you can create different types of environments. It seems to be that sort of hitting a positive nerve, let's say. But I know that they're also observing where we have made quite major changes to what the environment was before, and just sort of see how efficient that makes it. But it's a recurring theme in the art center I was mentioning. Also, we had large office spaces, and it just had to be a balance of enclosed spaces, very large open plan spaces, and then also recognize they can easily work in the cafe or dollar or meet somebody downstairs. So those two projects, strangely, although one was arts and one was corporate, those same work requirements were being echoed, you know, or testing them anyway.
So knowing what you know and seeing what you've seen, if you had to predict, which way do you think it's going? You know, the hot desking concept was a failure at the start, but there's been enough experimentation that it seems to be working quite nicely now. Do you see it going more in that direction, or do you see it going back to the point where people have more their set individual space with regard to the workplace?
It probably depends a lot. I mean, not trying to avoid the question, it probably does depend on a lot on exactly the type of office. In each of the ones I just mentioned, I felt very strongly that each person liked the idea that they knew where their desk was on some level. They maybe very rarely sat there, and maybe they also worked at home. But there is something, I think, about liking to know your place in the world. That just seems, again, a fairly primal desire. So I don't think that it will revert towards this sort of formal condition where you only sat there.
But wait a minute, let me stop you for 1 second. Yeah. Because something that you had said, and I see this too, this is where I get caught up. So here in LA was created as a car culture.
It wasn't created that way.
No, it was created that way.
No.
Oh, yeah.
What we see of it now was that, but it was created, but its layout is totally from the Pacific Red Car line. So it was a public transport network that laid it out.
It's true, but...
The car changed it dramatically.
That's true, but Los Angeles is a different city. LA is...
Yeah, it's a very different...
It's a different city than it was when the Red Line and when the streetcars were
here. Yeah, let's
say
contemporary here. Los Angeles. Yeah.
Fair enough. But the way that we know LA right now, since the 50s.
Yeah, 40s probably.
Yeah. So it's been a car culture. And my point is that at no point, if you asked anyone coming up through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, would you give up your car? People in LA would think you're nuts.
Yeah.
Cars are as important. So
well,
now...
I think the car is a place in the world, right? Your own car. So it's similar, I think.
But that's my point. Mm-hmm. Ride-sharing services have taken off here.
Mm-hmm.
Metro is taking off here.
Mm.
I didn't think, as a native Angeleno, I never thought I would see that.
Mm.
So it makes me wonder the whole concept of other sharing opportunities and work sharing, life sharing, you know, residential sharing.
It's just, it was just a recurring sense like the. And maybe it's because we're breaking through a culture, I'm not sure, but there was just a recurring sense that some didn't need to be very big, but some sort of defined spot of territory that was able to have that person's name associated with it. Again, even if they spent every day in one of the sort of more shared meeting areas, there was just like tethering. And I do think that is a human trait, that you want to know in a way a line back to somewhere that is specifically, that you can specifically see as your own.
Yeah.
So I think we do it somehow or other, because you could describe that you know, moment when I was there, it's like LA kind of blew apart, the conventional downtown blew apart, and it was because of the car allowed that to happen. But then people were tethered to their car. So I think we, and now maybe we're not tethered, maybe we won't be. I mean, I don't have a car here, I never really have. And I think that's partly because I do come from places where I didn't have one, and also I think I really like to see the, I like to see the city outside of a car. I like being in other people's cars because I find that fun too. But I think the way you see the city on metro or by bike is different. But you do tether again because you like to take the particular train. So Uber is different, like the Uber Express pool, where it's like a sort of every day or every moment it's a new bus route. And you can join. That's very exciting, and I think we haven't really seen that before. So I agree. Again, we're probably in a moment of being exposed to new systems. I just feel that we also like routine. We like things that we know about a bit, and that's just a way of tethering. Do you see what I mean?
I absolutely do.
And it's and totally landmarks true. Are a way of doing that. I think it's an interesting moment. I think it will be people work away from the office a lot more. Just to answer your question, travel doesn't seem to be reducing, even though it should on paper. We seem to all be doing more for business. And I think the home working thing it's very real. You know, people who have an on-office desk, a very senior role, they have their own office, they maybe don't go in there 2 or 3 days a week. And they're productive, and that's really, I suppose, what matters. As long as they're productive and the communication channels work, then I think that offices are fairly, you know, open-minded now in a way they wouldn't have been 5 years ago about how it all comes together and, you know, it makes itself happen. So I'm sure home working will be stronger. But I can't imagine a situation where everybody's divorced from a sort of mothership physically. I mean, I know companies, there are many companies that are that way, but I can't imagine that becoming the sort of the typical or the aimed for totally.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to find out for sure. Peter, where can people find you?
Well, the company is called Spatial Affairs Bureau, Instagram at Spatial Affairs, Twitter at Spatial Affairs. That will get you to us.
Outstanding. This is great, Peter.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks so much for the conversation. Great.
Absolutely. That was architect Peter Cully, and this is architect Lorcan O'Herlihy.
Most of our work primarily is in, I've been in Los Angeles for over 25 years. I have a practice here. I'm very obsessed with the city and urban culture. So most of our work is addressing urban infill projects, where Los Angeles is one of the most dense cities in Los Angeles, if not the most dense. So what we're working with is inserting infill projects, like stitching into the city. There's a great difference between Los Angeles. We're looking at a very different scenario in Detroit, where there is this idea of open plant, open fields. There's this great challenge there, in a sense that you have to design for the future, because the urban fabric is very different. You have fields surrounding your projects. So primarily that's a critical issue. So it's an inverted, in a way, figure ground condition, where Los Angeles is stitching into the city, Detroit, open fields. And what you build, you not only have to see design for that site, but also imagine the future, which is an extraordinary issue, because it really informs our projects to say, okay, open up, make it more porous, have accessible edges, recognize that it's about the people, about walking and about the ecology of Detroit. There's such a fascination between the people there about what's going on in Detroit. They're very possessive. They want great work. So very, very extraordinary process we're going through.
It's interesting, too, and it's hard to say this without coming off negative. So I try my best not to do that. But being born and raised native Angeleno, you know, when I was growing up in the San Fernando Valley, there were orange groves. And there was all kinds of space, and it depended on, you know, what, even over the hill, even on this side of the hill, there were still spaces. And I've seen in a few short decades the biggering and biggering of the city without a real strategic plan to that. And I'm curious, in your opinion, why does that happen? And the second part of that is, does a city like Detroit, with this revitalization that it's going through, have a chance to not make the same mistakes of Los Angeles?
Yes, I believe so. The zoning that was done in Los Angeles is rather antiquated now. It was a top-down strategy. And as you know, the industrial area, zone industrial and zone residential, zone commercial, was a strategy that does not work today. The nature of the culture that exists in Los Angeles is a shared culture. It's also people who want to come back to urban areas, and they want to be able to live in an apartment, walk down the street, and go over to the supermarket. They want to be able to work there. So they want to live there, they want to work there. Previously, there was always about living in one place, get in your car, and drive to your work. Very different condition, very different scenario. That has been very hard to break that mold. So there has to be more balance of top-down and bottom-up strategies in the city of Los Angeles, and they can learn from Detroit in that way, because right now there's many bottom-up strategies about new zoning in Detroit, because the people and the planning departments are in the same, feel the same way. They're like kindred spirits. They understand we need to rethink this. This can't work this way. And right now in Detroit, the zoning is not dissimilar. You have industrial areas, you have residential areas, and it's isolating people. So right now what they're trying to do is allowing for opportunities for having a street which has housing, but also a library and a market. And that's something that is very easy to do in Detroit, given its scale. There are 680,000 people in Detroit, which is, interestingly enough, the same size of just South Los Angeles. So you can imagine, with the size of Detroit, there's greater flexibility and looseness about how they can redefine their zoning. That's something LA could learn from. There has to be more of a balance and a flexibility in programming.
And don't you think, too, that there has to be more collaboration and communication? You know, here in LA, the podcast, we cover primarily architecture and interior design. And one of the things that has really been coming up with regularity over the last year and a half is the concept of we, here in LA, we keep tearing down Neff's and Schindler's, and these remarkable architectural projects are being torn down, A, because nobody knows what they are when they move into them, and B, because they're gems, they're jewels, but they're not categorized, and they're not protected. So Detroit, I think, runs a similar risk, but in many cases, some of these houses are too far gone. Any ideas how you address that?
Yeah. So one of our projects is called Brush Park. It's with a company called Bedrock, and Dan Gilbert, who owns Quicken Loans, is the owner. The site that we're working on, it's over 400 units, but there are five existing Victorian houses on the site. Four exactly on it, one that's a little bit off-site, and they're being fully restored. So that particular project is addressing that in a very conscientious, holistic way. We're restoring those houses. We didn't tear them out. We kept them because we felt this idea of Detroit is very much about old and new, about restoring existing buildings and bringing new. And how that relationship between the two is extremely important. Part of the reason I landed that project in Detroit is one of my earlier projects was building next to the Schindler House. It was a housing project that was very controversial when I was doing it. It turned out to be a very successful project. It was an instrumental or a tipping point for my practice. How do you build next to historical landmarks? I proportionally designed the project to drop it 15 feet lower so shadows weren't cast on it. You have to embrace these historical landmarks. Another project I did is in Westwood, next to Richard Neutra Strathmore Apartments. Again, a very conscientious, strategic design that recognizes the ideas about that were embedded in Richard Neutra Strathmore Apartments and build upon that idea. So that particular building is a step massing, two-story, which is which is parallels the Strathmore Apartments two-story building, but stepped up the volume to a 6 to 7 story building where the density was 6 to 7 story. So you have to strategically think to build that way. I've also renovated recently Julia Schulman's house, which was designed by Rafael Soriano. And that was a wonderful experience. It was a historical landmark. I worked with Lambert at the Office of Historical Resources, and we worked together to restore and renovate that project, but also recognize that it's a home for a family now. And so we were able to replace in kind the components of Julia Schulman's house that had great distress. But we also looked at the bathrooms and the kitchens and the mechanical system and brought that to a contemporary place. So there's a balance between, again, old and new, and that was a very important one. I've also renovated a number of other Nurture projects and Schindler projects.
So, last question. Where does the primary responsibility for that lie? Does it fall on the architect once you've already got the project secured? Does it fall on the homeowner, who has to have some responsibility for knowing what it is, the project that they want to work on, the homeowner, landowner, whatever? Or does it fall on the municipality to understand what they have and to proactively work their zoning and code system?
It's got to be a hybrid of all. The municipality has to know what they have and recognize the importance of it. So they have to set the framework or a platform for people to understand, okay, this house that you own is a significant historical project, but we recognize that it's 2017 and not 1940. So how do we work with you to keep the most significant elements of that that's historical, but recognizes your family with 3 kids and this is a 1-bedroom house? So how do we make that work? I learned that from working with Lambert here in Los Angeles, where he was more interested in looking at historical houses as a living organism, that it should be for families. And it should have, it changes all right if it's handled strategically and smart. We compare that to the Kaufman House that was restored back to its museum quality house, but not really for a home. And so it's a very interesting shift that people recognize now that in Europe, I always use the example in Europe, in Madrid in particular, those buildings are 500 to 600 to 1,000 years old. There is a very more healthy approach towards historical buildings, where they stitch in new programs if, in the event that 2017, the program has changed since the 14th century or 18th century for that matter, that they have to be able to change and replace that's appropriate for the program today. And they are fine with it. And if you look at the work in Spain or Madrid in particular, wonderful buildings that have been there for many, many centuries, but have been restored in a very unique way. But there's a freshness and a vitality to it, and it works, which means 300 years from now, they can change it again. Change is fine.
As long as it happens in perspective.
Yes.
Yeah. Lorcan O'Herlihy. Lorcan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Convo by Design is proud to be working with Vendome Furniture. Design culture, it's the key to their success. It's what pushes them to consistently create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Vendome pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that is both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest? Vendome products are simple and elegant, contemporary and exceptionally comfortable. Their crafted, modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique and they beg to be enjoyed. They search the planet for the right designers that embody the Vendome spirit and work together to create remarkable pieces into an exclusively Vendome mode of expression. And if you haven't seen Vendome before, you can check them out in some of the Convo by Design videos you'll find on our YouTube channel. But you can find them in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and the Pacific Design Center here in LA, or online at vendome.com.